But what really, according to Maimonides, and I believe this, is that highest level of philanthropy is taking someone on as a business partner. Not only are you teaching them, but you are actually sharing in the responsibility and the wealth, and you're saying that I respect you in this equation. I'm not over you. We are partners. And this is really the ultimate measure of respect. Welcome to How Women Inspire, where women lead, invest, and give. I'm your host, Julie Castro Abrams, founder and CEO of How Women Lead, and managing partner of the venture firm How Women Invest. Feminist, social justice warrior, mother, friend of 50,000 plus badass women, and an expert at helping top executive women get on boards and break down barriers for women entrepreneurs, investors, and social impact activists. In this podcast, we interview women influencers and leaders from across the globe who are in the C-suite, founding companies, investing, and agents of change. We'll share stories of how women lead. We'll provide insights and data, tips you can put into action, and get to know the women who have fiercely and unabashedly stepped into their power in leadership and opened doors for other women like you. We discuss topics ranging from the journey of getting a board seat, how we can counter cultural frameworks that change the way the world views women leaders, what we're doing to close the gender funding gap, and driving equity for women in all aspects of life and career. My goal is that after every episode, you walk away feeling inspired, unstoppable, ready to level up and step into your power and influence. I want to break down the cultural narratives that hold us back collectively and those messy messages you heard that are taking up way too much of your brain space. I want you to know you're invited in, because I know that together we can change the culture, change opportunities, and create the future we want for our daughters and sisters and friends. This is our time. Are you in? Welcome to today's episode of How Women Inspire. Some people have asked me to share my story of philanthropy and impact. Giving anonymously is considered one of the highest forms of philanthropy. So I have a little bit of discomfort sharing my story, but I'm going to take a stab at it here because I think it's important for all of us to take a moment and reflect about the impact we want to have in our lives. And I know that there's a developmental stage between about 45 and 65 where having an impact is literally one of the most important parts of this life stage. So I hope that this is helpful to you and your own thinking. I actually grew up in a home that wasn't philanthropic at all. In fact, at one point, in time when I was running a nonprofit, my mom asked me why anyone would want to donate to my organization. She was really genuinely confused. I don't judge her for that because it wasn't part of her way of thinking. But I grew up Catholic and I was profoundly impacted by the invitation in what you learned to open your hearts and doors as a Good Samaritan, to care for other people, to love and accept others deeply as they are, and even to give away your worldly goods to care for others. I remember weeping at injustice when I was a little girl, and it always struck me deeply that some people have resources and safety and other people don't or can be in such pain. And I certainly don't understand ignoring people who are in pain or who have less. But I definitely don't understand anyone actively trying to hurt other people. So with all that said, I'm sure you understand and agree with a lot of what I just said. But for me, I made a decision. I made a decision to spend my entire life trying to make the world a better place. And most importantly, to be on a lifetime journey to love others unconditionally, wholeheartedly, without judgment and without expectation. I'm not perfect. And I am on my own journey for sure. But that's how I am when I'm at my best, when I am my very best self. Of course, in my late teens, and certainly reinforced in college, you know, I became disillusioned by the abuses and hypocrisy of the Catholic Church. You know, I'll never forget even my mother saying, don't be alone with Father Collins because he pinches little girls. He was still invited over for dinner. And what matters most in the Catholic Church I grew up with was what you're wearing. There was judgment all over the place, and that wasn't okay to me. I think that's a familiar story to a lot of us, and so enough said about that. Also, as a little girl, I vividly remember my extended family members who lived in the South making grossly racist comments and just being stunned and outraged. And I couldn't understand how you could both think of yourself as somebody who was religious or had any kind of integrity and behave like that. Of course, that started this commitment to me for racial justice to become a priority. Of course, I had a very long learning curve myself to understand how not to have a white savior complex and all the messiness that comes with the white guilt and all the other garbage that separates all of us. So my undergrad is in human development and social policy from Northwestern, and I got a wonderful, powerful education about racial justice and feminism. I had some professors that really challenged me and humbled me. And I'm eternally grateful for that discomfort, for their courage. And I mean, I didn't take that much courage probably to talk to an 18-year-old the way they talked to me, but I learned a lot. And this is where I really began to understand the complexity around issues of reproductive choice and the undue burden put on all women, but mostly disenfranchised or low-income women. So I decided to go to graduate school in social service administration at the University of Chicago. It was a wonderful scaffolding for me, and I studied social service administration with a focus on health policy and administration. And my memory is that the very first class where the professor set the stage for why are you here in this social service administration program and talk to us about power. A lot of people go into a helping profession because ultimately it feels good. It feels good to get recognition, feels good to get gratitude from people. And I get that. We all appreciate that, right? However, you have to be aware of issues of power. For example, if you're working in a nonprofit, making a low wage and trying to help people, from your perspective, you don't have a lot of power. And you're sacrificing yourself. That said, the people who are seeking the services know you're getting paid and it's your responsibility to help them, so they can be very demanding and not grateful because they know you're getting paid. And this is the really messy stuff. You don't think you have power, but if you have any power over their opportunities, if you can remove them from a class or other support, you have power over them. And that can cause all kinds of complexity in the relationship and in that engagement. You may feel like you don't have power, but from their perspective, you do. And you have to be cognizant of that. And you cannot expect gratitude. And that was, it was really important to lean into and just be honest with yourself about that. We all have needs for acknowledgement and people giving us gratitude. You got to get it from somewhere else in some of those situations. And really just understanding this lifetime inquiry around power. So I never wanted to be hypocritical like the people that I felt like I grew up with were being hypocritical. So it became essential for me to think about how I wanted to show up in this business of helping others. I came across a philosopher who talked about philanthropy, Maimonides. Thousands of years ago, this philosopher came up with a ladder of philanthropy. So in concept, someone could probably tell me I'm saying some of this wrong, but this is how I think of it. First, you give because you get something. You give because you get your earthquake preparedness kit. Next, you give because you get some social access. You get to go to a party and meet people that you need to know, maybe, or that can make you feel good that you're part of something bigger than yourself. It feels wonderful. And you give because you get recognition. You get your name on a building. It feels great. So beyond that type of philanthropy that we all participate in, and it's important, but giving anonymously for many people is what you consider the pinnacle of giving. You get no social credit and no one knows. But what really, according to Maimonides, and I believe this, is that highest level of philanthropy is taking someone on as a business partner. Not only are you teaching them, but you are actually sharing in the responsibility and the wealth, and you're saying that I respect you in this equation. I'm not over you. We are partners. And this is really the ultimate measure of respect. And so my approach was starting to become clear as I thought about that as a framework. And as I began to study the history of poverty and the extraordinary cost of poverty, both human and financial, I started to form a philosophy around my own impact. First, I realized the power of the definition of your identity. If you were a child in 1995 living in public housing in Chicago, in many ways, you identified for services and at school as a child in public housing. And it started to become a badge of honor for some people because sometimes it feels empowering to own that. And in many ways, it started to become a self-limiting belief for people to say, like, this is the girl or the boy from public housing, right? And what happens when that young person actually can add another identity? In the case of the work that I did, they would define themselves as a violinist, as a trumpet player, because I worked in a music conservatory for low-income kids. What's stunning is when you give someone, when somebody steps in to this, I'm a violinist, all of a sudden people around them, you act differently often, and people around you act differently. They think of you for your potential. They respond and react to you differently than other definitions that you've had before. And so I watched the magic of that and the power of that in this music conservatory for low-income kids and started to define for myself that I really wanted to work always in a strengths-based approach to poverty alleviation. That's my North Star. So after 7 years in that role, I was recruited to run a microfinance and microenterprise organization out of California, and half of the programming was in Spanish. So I was sold because I speak Spanish, and the Latino community is important to me. So working with low-income women who may be a domestic violence survivor and helping her reframe her identity, giving her a path, giving her tools and resources and support to become a CEO of her own business. Now that's transformational for her children, and for her community. And treating her as a business partner, as opposed to somebody without power seeking social services, you know, was transformational. And we were very careful every step of the way that the women involved with us didn't feel like they were powerless. They felt like they were powerful. And sometimes that's complex and messy, and they can get demanding because they're trying it on, try power on for a moment. But it was really important to do. So we became the largest organization providing microenterprise and microfinance for women in the United States. We had a statistician on staff and could prove the financial impact on families and communities. We used a regression analysis, my statistics from University of Chicago, to see why and what were the features that helped someone build and sustain a successful business and make enough money to sustain their family. Our work informed national impact, and we were regularly asked to speak at conferences and share our strategy. It was beautiful and powerful and impactful, and those countries are still in business, and it was hard. It was extremely hard to run a social service agency where you had to raise every dollar. And, you know, Jim Collins did a compendium to the book Good to Great, talking about the nonprofit sector, and he said, it is the hardest leadership role because you have so many stakeholders. You are beholden to everybody when you're running a nonprofit. You're beholden to your staff and your board and your funders, but you're also beholden to the entire community because really nonprofits are owned by the public. 85% of executive directors will only do it once because it is so exhausting and hard. So after 11 years running that organization, I decided I was going to retire and do consulting. I was like, I'm never going to run anything again. It was too hard. I loved that I did it, but I was tired. And I have to tell you again, I was so glad I did it because I still go to the restaurants and buy the products and services of the women who were involved with me. So 20 years later, they're still in business. So I have a world of impact I get to see that is pretty amazing. And as I started to look inside and think, what is the impact that I want to have after running that organization? I really started to think, what is the greatest you know, lever for change. Like I felt often powerless running my organization because the structures in the United States were not supportive. And there are people in power who didn't understand and weren't engaged. And so what I decided for this next half, the next part of my life, call it the next third of my life, is to focus on levers for the greatest change. And to me, right now in 2023, leveraging the power of women leaders and working with them to meet new levels of impact and leadership, including board roles, adventure, impact in venture capital, and more, women's access to capital, is the place to do that. And so that is a structural national level leadership and impact. And so often people come to me and say, I really want to think about my own philanthropy. And what I often say to people is, here's my approach for my personal needs, to get my own personal needs met. I like to work on three different levels of impact. One, I like to have one-on-one impact. I like to see the person or people that I'm helping. It feels great. And I like to take people on as a business partner in that way, right? I also like to support local organizations and smart strategies to help communities. So there's some scale about of the impact. And then I like to work on the structures, national structures, for example, that impact all of those individuals and system and institutions and systems. So impacting policies and practices that will end up ultimately sustain some of the solutions, the changes we're trying to make in the world. Each one of these three is rewarding and limited in its own way. So I always say, if you can do all three, doesn't have to all be at the same time, but if you do all three, you actually have a huge impact and can get a lot of personal rewards. So there you go. That's one thing you might want to think about in your own giving. So I'll share with you some examples for us. For 33 years, my husband and I have made a commitment to doing that one-on-one work. In fact, his share of commitment to family and being a moral person and taking action is one of the reasons why I married him. And of course, we have been, I'm a social worker by training, you know, obviously, you know, we have a unique perspective in the world. And we're, so we're the safe place for family members who needed a place to stay, sometimes for months, sometimes for years, whether it's my brother or cousin or nephew. Everybody knows our house is the house for all the wayward children. And I love that. I love being able to be a safe place. In addition to our family members, we also hosted an Italian exchange student for a year. And that was really interesting and rewarding in certain ways. I also organized four other friends, and we helped a Rwandan woman go to college to become an engineer. We paid for her flights and her books and her clothes, and we hugged her and supported her. During Thanksgiving, we played Santa for her and coached her and housed her during the summers and for the year after college. Both my biological children and my Rwandan daughter lived with us for a year after college. And honestly, she has integrated into our family as a daughter for nearly 10 years. Every holiday, every birthday, every win, every sadness, career coaching and love life. She's my daughter's best friend. She laughs and cries with us. We hug and eat popcorn together. And having her in our lives is one of the greatest gifts. Her mother just came to stay with us for the first time. She came to the United States for the first time this holiday. And she was very interesting. She said, I don't understand why you've done so much for my daughter. And for years, we didn't get it. And at a certain point, she's like, my husband and I have decided that we want to be more like you. We are going to give back and open our home and do things for other young people in our community. And what a gift is that, to feel like you've given somebody, I don't know, that perspective to maybe evolve. So that was pretty beautiful. And ultimately, having Chartine in our lives has been one of the best things we've ever done. And she's a beautiful human being. And I think we just lucked out. She's just like our kids. She's smart and kind and disciplined and hardworking and fun, and we laugh. So I have two more stories I want to tell you about, and these are a little more intense and complex. So first I'll tell you about Carmina. We were young. I was in my 20s. My youngest had just been born. I think I was 28. And her sister had been a babysitter because we'd lived not too far from where her family had lived. And we moved away at this point and bought our first house. And I get this call from Carmina and I'm like, why are you calling me? Ultimately, because she was, you know, she was 13, like, you know, why she would call us, right? But she said she got attacked on her way to school. And unfortunately, the school that was a block and a half away from her house was not the school she was supposed to be going to. She was supposed to be going to school 2 miles away. They were both public schools, but somehow there was some weird line in the sand, right, in the city. And so she had been using her uncle's address. And so her mother was illiterate, didn't even know how to cross the street. So she was not, there was no way to get Carmina to school. And so we said, well, how about this? We'll pay for you to go to the Catholic school in the neighborhood. And she said she didn't want to do that. She said she wanted to come live with us. So we became her guardians. And Kenneth was an infant and Elizabeth was three. And we didn't have any money. And we did it with a lot of sacrifice. And I spent hours every single night, Raul and I, and Graciela, who lived with us, our nanny and family member, we would sit with Carmina and we taught her how to read. So here she was 13 and she really didn't know how to read in either language, but certainly she was struggling with English a lot and didn't know math. And so Raul's our math guy in the house. So Raul did the math. We spent 9 months. And ultimately, Carmina said, living with us was like living with nuns. And you know what? It probably was. We were boring compared to her chaotic life, to be honest. And so when you turn 14, if you are in, we were her legal guardians, you go to court at that time and you can say where you want to live. And she said, I want to go home. I want to go back home. And it was hard for us. We'd given her so much. And I knew intellectually, no gratitude, but you know, it's hard. It's hard when you give so much. You invite someone into your home. And then it just felt bad. But whatever, that's life. We were super busy with our own babies. And, you know, obviously I was working at the Merritt School of Music and Music Conservatory for low-income kids. You know, I had a full, full big life. And so we moved on. Well, it's very interesting. It's like 7 years later, we're moving to California. The next day I'd sold my house. Everything was packed. The night before we moved, I get a call out of the blue from Carmina. And at this point, she was 19, I think. I was like, wow, Carmina, how are you? Nice to hear from you. And literally the next day, she would not have been able to find us because we were on landlines at this point. I think I had a cell phone at this point, but she certainly didn't have that cell phone number. She said, I was wondering if you can get me a job like where you work downtown. And I said, well, what do you say, right? I was like, well, what have you done? What have you been up to? And she left our home at 14 and never went back to school. And she had two babies and she got married and she was 19 with two babies. She'd been in an abusive relationship and she left him. And I was like, I am moving tomorrow. I don't know how to help you at this point. And I, you know, tried to tell her, you know, what community colleges I knew she could go to finish her GED. That's all I had I could offer at that point. So this is where it gets interesting. A couple of years ago, my friend Ann Devereaux was writing a book about small acts of kindness. And she's talking about the small stuff. You pay for someone's coffee. You know, if you ever find out what the ripple effect might be of that small act of kindness without any intention of response. Well, she kind of said to me, well, Julie, you're a weird one because your whole life, everything you do, you work, everything is around helping other people. And I don't know why in that conversation I said, you know, it's so interesting. Carmina, who had lived with us, just friended me on Facebook. You know, this was in, you know, a handful of years ago, probably in 2018 or 19. And Anne was like, let's have a call with Carmina and see if your relationship with her and ever had an impact on her. And so Anne and I had a call with Carmina. And Carmina said, because of course, you know, if you look at it on paper, she never went back to school. She had two babies before she was 19. Like, that's a failure. It didn't work what we did. Well, a couple of little things that were interesting is Carmina said to us, actually, I had you whispering in my head, in my ear, when I was in an abusive relationship. And I felt like I could hear you in my head saying, be strong and get out, and you deserve more. So she left an abusive relationship, maybe because of something, some impact we had on her. And she said, and I tell my kids they have to graduate from high school, that that's the one thing they have to do for me. And that felt a little, it felt good. It felt a little better. I have enough perspective. I'm old enough in my life to know that like small wins scaffold and things aren't necessarily going to happen in one person's life, but generational impact can be significant. And that was interesting. And then Raul's nephew, my nephew, Jorge, calls us up and he says, I'm getting married. And we're like, okay, we're going to go to the wedding. And this was in August 2022, just a couple months ago. We get to the wedding and who is organizing the whole wedding, because she's in the family of his new wife, but Carmina. She's the first person we saw when we walked into the church. So here it is, like all these years later, and there's Carmina. And I find out, like, basically my nephew married her cousin. So we go to the wedding and it's kind of interesting. Everybody's like, oh, and a little bit of like, you kind of feel like there's a little whispering going on. And then we go to the reception and I almost felt like, wow, is this going to be awkward? Is it going to be uncomfortable? Well, her family was so generous with their words and just like, oh my God. And they kept saying, Julie and Raul are the nicest people in the world. It was so fascinating, you know, at this stage in life to go to this wedding with these young people. And it felt like everybody had been impacted in some way. Like it was a big deal and it felt beautiful. So to me, that's a full circle moment. That was pretty fantastic. And we spent the whole weekend with her and her extended family, and they kept saying beautiful things about us. So that's kind of nice. One more story. Another one where I don't know how the tale has ended up, but we'll see. We decided in the early 2000s, mid-2000s, that our kids are so healthy and great. And it was very painful to see that after 9/11, there was such horrific treatment of immigrants. And there were raids going on all over the place. And all these Latinos, like, why would they have anything to do with Twin Towers, right? But it was a reaction. And we decided to become foster parents, thinking, you know, we will care for one of these Latino kids whose parents are being deported. And that was really the impetus for us. And really feeling like our home is special and safe, and we speak Spanish. And it felt like that would be a good thing for us to do. And so we went through the classes and everything. And so you get the call and they say to you, okay, well, we have siblings, a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. Well, we hadn't planned on two, but they were like, and we need a place for them right now, like immediately. They're going to bring them over in a couple hours. And I called Raul and we've been planning to do this. And so he quit his job and I took some time off work and we had the worst case of abuse and neglect. They'd had him run into 10 years in our county. Think about this, a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old, they were front page news. Their mom was a meth addict and a hoarder, and her mom had been a hoarder. And what's so stunning is when you have child abuse, suspected child abuse, the police can't do anything. If they knock on the door, no one opens the door. But if there's animal cruelty, they can. And so there had been multiple reports of child endangerment of some sort, and nobody had been able to do anything. But there was a report of animal abuse. And so they go into this home and dead animals and the most horrific environment. And they were surprised to find the two kids. They didn't know they were going to find the two kids. And so anyway, front page news, pretty intense. So here we are, Raul and I, first time foster parents. They never should have given us a case. I mean, kids like this for first time foster parents, but we rallied everybody. We had a friend who was a speech therapist, and we had a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old with no language acquisition at all. None, no words. And kind of actually some kind of sounded like a little bit of a made up-y kind of language almost, but none, no real language acquisition, and severe health issues, like teeth rotted to the root, you know, the whole, just like everything in psychology 101, and truly just horrific neglect and some abuse. And so we did that for 6 months. And at the end, you know, a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old either have to be reunited with their parent, and this mother wasn't capable, she went to jail, or they need to be adopted. And for us, we decided when you're 5 and you've never bonded with anyone, it's hard to say this, but like sociopathy is, that's how a sociopath is born. And we were thinking the cost to our own children and our entire lifetime of commitment was too much. That was too high of a bar for us at that point. And so they were adopted by a lesbian couple. One is a kindergarten teacher and the other one is a child psychologist. So wasn't that a perfect thing? And so these young children had a loving, supportive, therapeutic home that they could go into. And so that was really important for us. I'm just sharing to you sort of our own journey that wasn't always easy. Like that was hard. It was really hard. If you're a parent, and even if you're not, you might know this, but the night before your child speaks their first word, they throw a temper tantrum. And then the next day they say their first word and you're like, oh, that's why they were having a temper tantrum yesterday. Well, think about that. Like the 5-year-old in particular, like nonstop developmental growth, learn to speak in full sentences in 6 months. And, you know, whatever, they'd never eaten certain like healthy foods. All they'd had really, it seems to us, like all they'd ever had was like ramen noodles. Right. And so just brain agitation, screaming and having to hold this tiny little person while they screamed and to help them in the loving embrace. But boy, was that hard. It was hard on our biological children. And so we've had a commitment and it hasn't always been rewarding, but it in the long run, we are so grateful that we were able to be in their lives in this way. And so today we have a budget line item to send money to my husband's family in Mexico, probably about $1,000 a month is what it's ending up being, which is a lot for us. And we continue to do a couple other things. So I'll say, as a parent, you want your kids to learn these values. And it's very interesting because none of our kids work in social impact today. They're still in their 20s. And I would like to see them being more philanthropic and giving back. But what we do is they put money, their own $500 each, and we put money into a fund. And as a family, we give a college scholarship to a Latina immigrant who's the first in her family to go to college and needs support. And that's really beautiful as a family. We interview a couple people every year and we make a choice. So I guess ultimately I want to say, like, I've lived my life with a commitment to making the world a better place and having an impact and integrity. I am certainly a work in progress. You know, you could poke a million holes in my life. So either have at it or please don't, because like I'm sharing with you our story. We're all on a journey. But I would say for you, like having a North Star of your values and committing consistently to making the world a better place, to me, this has been an extraordinary gift in my life, in my marriage, in my relationships with others, and in dark times, being able to help somebody else is one of the greatest things to help you feel better. And ultimately, I'm at peace. Philosophers will tell you that having a goal and striving is one of the critical parts of the human condition to be happy and at peace. I think I'm going to be at peace for a long time because it doesn't look like I'm ever going to change the world to the point that I want it to be at, or meeting my goal for love to be at the centerpiece. But love and radical acceptance of others is a guidepost for me. And I would love to think that maybe hearing this might encourage you to adopt that a little bit more. And I'm going to spend the rest of my life being in service to other people and to try and make the world a better place in the way I can. And I hope that you too will find that for yourself. Thank you.
And with that,
I want to thank you all for listening to today's episode of How Women Inspire. And because your inspiration should not stop when this podcast ends, head over to our website, howwomenlead.com. Follow us on LinkedIn at How Women Lead and subscribe or follow on your favorite podcast app to find out how you can proactively take charge and step into your power through our workshops and activism. In our loving network, we want to propel you. See you next time, ladies. And remember to be unabashedly visible.